Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for Voice of Indie. Your hosts today are Beam Weeks, author, producer, and marketing monster for independent multimedia publisher Fresh Ink Group, and Stephen G., author, producer, composer, and publisher for Fresh Ink Group.
And good evening, and welcome to episode 18 of The Voice of Indie. And in case you're noticing, I'm Beam Weeks, by the way, your host. In case you're noticing my voice, I sound like Wheezy Jefferson. I'm getting over, trying to get over strep throat. So my co-host, as usual, is Stephen G's, and Stephen is probably going to do most of the show tonight, but I'm going to be here in the background. How you doing tonight, Stephen?
Well, my voice is a little bit better than yours, but I'm feeling all right. Sorry to hear you're under the weather, but glad that you're improving, and we all wish you the best. We want to remind our listeners that these shows are archived in four different places. So after you hear tonight's show, you can share it with other people. Go to freshinkgroup.com to the podcast tab, where right now the placards are all blurry, but we're working on getting that fixed in the next couple of days. You can go to beamweeks.com, stephengees.com, or go to YouTube. Everybody's heard of YouTube. Go there and search for the Fresh Ink Group channel, and you can find all 18 of our podcasts so far, or close to 18 of them anyway, and a whole bunch of book trailers and other videos that we've made as well.
Okay. You can also, if you would like to participate in tonight's show, you can give us a call on the phone lines. That is phone number 516-453-9902. Once again, that is 516-453-9902, and we will put you on the air.
Also, if you'd like to participate through Twitter tonight, go to Twitter and put in the search bar hashtag Fresh Ink Group and click on the latest. And then just anytime you want to put a question in for our guest or make a comment, something like that, just do it as a tweet and remember to include hashtag Fresh Ink Group somewhere in the body of the tweet. Now, that's not at Fresh Ink Group. That's hashtag, the old pound sign, hashtag Fresh Ink Group. Now, our guest today is Marcia Fox. She's one of our favorite writers. We've known her for some time now, and we've read her books. We've talked to her before in other interviews, and basically always enjoy having Marcia. Marcia Fox is a prolific writer who has addressed a wide variety of subjects, but one of her favorites is science fiction. It began as a love of astronomy, which eventually led to a Bachelor of Science degree in physics from Utah State University. This was followed by a 21-year career at NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas, where she held a variety of positions, including technical writer, engineer, and eventually manager. Her NASA experiences included trips to Cape Canaveral in Florida, visiting other NASA centers in Mississippi, Alabama, and Maryland, as well as trips to the European Space Agency in the Netherlands. But the most memorable was the sad task of helping to recover space shuttle debris in East Texas following the tragic Columbia accident in 2003. Welcome to the show, Marcia.
I'm very pleased and honored to be here.
Oh, well, we're glad to have you. So we just hit the listeners with a little bit of your bio. There's quite a bit more of that over on Amazon if people want to go over and have a read. But why don't you expand on that a little bit for us? Tell us maybe about your family.
Well, I'm a mother of six kids, and they're all grown, and I have 17 grandkids, and most of them are grown or growing up too fast. The ones that are coming up in the rear are the younger ones. Five great grandkids, just kids all over the place, and they are literally kind of all over the place too. They live in Utah and Texas and Idaho and all over the place.
Now, you've been all over the place, too. You've lived basically from one end of the USA to the other. Can you mention some of the places you've called home?
As a kid, I grew up until, junior high in New York State in a little town called Peekskill that was about 40 miles north of New York City. So it was actually a commuter town. But, of course, when I was a kid growing up, that I didn't know. To me, 40 miles to New York seemed like a long way away. Now living in Texas, it's just up the road to the grocery store. But anyway, my parents moved to California when I was going into eighth grade and lived there for a while. We were in the San Francisco Bay Area when we lived in California. And I went to high school there, and I got married there, and my family, my husband and my kids eventually moved to Utah, and we lived there for a number of years and had a couple more kids, and that's where I went to school, was at Utah State. And then after graduating from there was when I wound up coming to Texas to work for NASA.
Wow. Been around. So now you're in Texas. You're in Texas Hill Country?
I am now, yes. I lived in Houston when I was working for NASA, or more specifically, a little town called Friendswood and then Clear Lake City, both of them suburbs of Houston. In fact, Clear Lake City has Houston zip code, so go figure. But anyway, yeah, I lived there until I retired, and then I moved to the Hill Country where I had a lake house, which started out as my hurricane evacuation plan from Houston.
Hurricane evacuation plan.
Now, when we talked the other day, I mentioned that our beloved Ann, who was our managing director at Fresh Ink Group for more than two decades, was from Texas Hill Country. We lost her to cancer a couple years ago, I'm sad to say, but she gave us a lot of great memories. And one is, every year she traveled with her husband back to Texas Hill Country from where they live near Dallas, and she took pictures of the blue bonnets and always sent me those pictures because it was her favorite thing to see in the world. Do you get a chance to see the blue bonnets?
Yes, I sure do, because I am in the Hill Country, and the little country road that heads from the state highway out to where I live is just totally flanked by bluebonnets in the spring. We get lots of tourists come out and drive down our road. It's on the Texas bluebonnet tour list as one of the best places to find them. And I live by a big man-made lake, actually. It's a reservoir called Lake Buchanan, and it's loaded with them in this whole area. And many years ago, well, not too many actually, but shortly after I retired in 2009, we went into a 7+ year drought up here, and the lake almost drained down to next to nothing. It's a part of the lower Colorado River, and so that's all it looked like, was not even really a respectable river. I mean, those of you that live back east and are familiar with the Hudson River or the Mississippi or the Missouri or whatever, Colorado River is kind of pathetic by comparison. But it was so pathetic during the drought that a man could straddle the inflow like the Colossus of Rhodes.
Oh, wow.
It was that low, the amount of water coming in. So it was all but dry. And at that time, one of the springs during the drought, all these bluebonnets sprung up along the naked beaches that were usually covered with water. And it was so beautiful, and it was kind of comforting thinking, well, we don't have water, but we still have blue. It was beautiful. But ironically, shortly after that, the lake came up, and it's been up ever since. Even though this year has been pretty dry, at least the lake has maintained a respectable level where it looks like a lake instead of a puddle or something. And it's a big lake. It's like 20 miles across and 50 miles long. It's not a little lake.
Wow. I encourage listeners to use your favorite search engine, Google, for example, and Google fields of blue bonnets or blue bonnet fields or something like that, and you'll just see how exquisitely beautiful they can be. And maybe next spring when the blue bonnets come back, Marsha will share some pictures on her social media.
I usually do. I know I have a one thing we do here is we'll mow around them if we have them in our yard. And where I live is pretty rural, and I don't really – well, I have a yard, but I don't have a lawn, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
It's not grass, it's weeds. And wherever the bluebonnets come up, I always mow around them. And the first one that comes out, I always take a picture and I put it on Instagram and Facebook and whatever, because it's kind of a special event when the bluebonnets start to bloom.
Well, we're going to hold you to it in 2021. So, Beam, you got a question? Yeah. You up for talking a little?
What I'll do here is we've got a couple of comments on Twitter. I'll throw those out here.
Okay.
We got Robert G. Williscroft is listening. He said, impressive bio. So there you go with that. Verwayne Greenhall, he says, regardless of what the wife might tell you, I'm good to go. I love sci-fi and sci-fi books. And Ronnie Deshay is in the audience tonight. She says, hi, guys. I made it tonight.
Hey, what's Ronnie?
Hi, Marsha. Waving.
Yeah,
so,
hi, Ronnie. I remember you.
Now, talking about you living all over the United States, Marsha, you've also been quite a world traveler. Where have you been around the world?
Mainly just Europe. And very limited in Europe, France, Germany, and the Netherlands. And, you know,
I've been a
world traveler. Went there for work a couple times. And when you're working, you're working, and you don't really get to sightsee that much. And then I went to visit my son, who was in the Air Force and stationed over there, and I went over to visit him for a couple weeks one time. And that was the best part, was when I could actually go and be a actual tourist and see things instead of over there working. So it was, you know, I guess the coolest thing that I remember, one of the most memorable parts, was visiting Strasbourg, France, because that's where my grandfather was from. And he had taught in the university there, and we went through the older parts of the town, and there were just some places that just felt very familiar to me. You know, it just, I felt a very strong connection, city. So that was probably the coolest part. That and the fact that in the Netherlands, I had a heavy coat, wool coat with zip-in lining, the whole bit, that I was really glad I had, and it was July.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, the wind that comes in off that North Sea is not friendly at all. And you think about people out there working on oil rigs and such, and it's like, oh my goodness, how do they even stand it? It was not very friendly. But
You say Netherlands, I picture great fields of tulips out there showing off and talking smack to the bluebonnet fields in Texas, you know?
Oh, yeah, so that's what I hear they are like, but I was always there the wrong time of year for the tulips, unfortunately.
One thing I'm curious about is you started with an interest in astronomy very young, but then when you got to Utah State, you decided to go straight physics. Why is that?
Well, that's the major you go for if you want to learn about astronomy and astrophysics.
Okay.
And so that was kind of the natural place to go to study that, and I took every astronomy class and astrophysics class that they had, but they didn't have a specific major in that area. It was just, you know, a bachelor's or a master's or whatever in physics. So I was a little slow going back to school. I was 35 years old and had 6 kids at home when I went back to school full time to get a physics degree, and I look back on that and think, what kind of insanity was that?
Oh, that's why you picked a cream puff degree, huh?
That's right. Yeah. Most people in my position with kids at home and whatever, they'd go back and they'd get like an elementary ed degree so they could teach in their kids' schools and stuff like that. And there's crazy Marcia going for a physics degree. And many times I really wondered what I was doing, except that was really part of my long-term plan to be a science fiction writer.
There it is.
I never wanted to write anything that was wrong or not convincing. And I thought, if I want to write good science fiction, I need to get the education behind it, which would be a physics degree, and then from there, preferably, work for an aerospace company or preferably NASA. I mean, I'm old enough, I remember the Apollo missions and when we walked on the moon, and that was when a lot of this dream kind of came to life was back then. So that was my plan. It's kind of a long, convoluted path to being a writer, but seriously, that is what I always wanted to be.
Well, we're glad you did. We're definitely glad you did. So you were reading.
Yeah, I'm not
obsessive
or anything, right?
You were reading science fiction back then?
Oh my goodness, I just was reading science fiction from when I was in elementary school. And, of course, about all I could find was what was in the school library, and that was Heinlein and those, you know, Asimov and the old-time ones that we're, some people
Arthur C.
today
Clarke.
Might not even be familiar with.
Arthur C. Clarke?
H.G. Wells, you know, Jules Verne. And I just loved it. I loved it. But I was always a little disappointed that I didn't learn any science in those books. They were great stories. But I always was interested in the science and thought, why don't they ever mention any of the science behind this stuff? After all, it's science fiction, right? So when I decided to start writing my own stories, I decided I am going to include some science in there so that kids that are reading it, especially kids that already have an interest in science, it will enhance the story. It will show the relevance of having an education in science and engineering, and it's painless learning when it's part of the story. And some of my fans that I've met that read my book that are of school age, they've just loved it. And they're like the, you know, they're little nerds, right? They're the ones that are really into science and everything, where everybody else thinks they're crazy, but they ate up my book. So if I could just reach more of them.
Your character, who is essentially a sentient plant, I really enjoy how you explain how that can be. You know, you explain the biology behind this alien being that's very different than what we're used to here on Earth. So,
The research I did on that book, the Terra debacle, oh my goodness. Because like I say, I'm obsessive on details. And so I didn't know anything about biology. I'm a physicist. So I had to do a lot of research and learn about that and talk to people. And fortunately, I had a friend who was a medical doctor, and he gave me some ideas on it and whatever. And so many of the things that came out were just those lucky little serendipitous breaks that are just so much fun about writing. And what I love about when you're doing research, where something just fits into the plot and everything that you wanted to achieve just perfectly. So,
right.
So it was a lot of fun writing that book.
So where do you come up with these ideas for stories like that one?
Well, that one was actually a spinoff from my science fiction series. It's actually a tetralogy of four books, but this telepathic walking plant is a minor character in the other books. And at one point in the second book, they got separated from the main characters. And I always knew they had a story of what happened to them when they were separated. So when I finally finished the series, I knew I wasn't really done. I had to tell the story about them when they were prisoners at Area 51. So it was a matter of, you know, it was a side story that would have been too much to fit into the second book at the time. It was already split between two different people in the, you know, this family gets separated, and so I'm following two plot lines as they're trying to get back together. So that was one of those things where I had to come back and write that story, and it turned out to be fun. It's standalone. It's actually my most popular book in the series because it is standalone.
Okay.
And, of course, the Area 51, you know, that's a hot topic, so it does pretty well.
Okay. And you've got a character who could almost be a plush doll.
Could almost be a what?
Could almost be a plush doll. You know, merchandising, Marcia, merchandising.
It could. I saw a meme, and it was a big old, probably some kind of big tree, but they took two white beach balls and painted a big black circle on them so they looked like eyes, and they put them up in the top of this tree. And when I saw that, I just died laughing because I thought, oh my gosh, that's Byron, or, you know, that would be one way to think of him, as the old tree with two eyes looking at you.
Wow. Okay, we're talking to Marcia Fox. We're encouraging people to call in at 516-453-9902 or go over to Twitter and use hashtag Fresh Ink Group and leave a comment or a question. We're going to take a very quick break and do a roll-in of a science fiction book by Robert G. Willis Croft called Icicle.
Now, introducing book one in the new series by master sci-fi storyteller Robert G. Willis Croft, Icicle. A Tensor Matrix, the first Oort Chronicle. Dying of prostate cancer, wealthy entrepreneur Braxton Thorpe is frozen in hopes of someday being revived and cured. That's when he discovers a threat to the entire solar system. But he has a problem. He's dead. He awakens to find himself uploaded into an electronic matrix. Exploring beyond the matrix and the larger global net, he discovers the Oort, a distributed electronic entity older than humanity, with an unnerving secret. Aliens wiped out nearly all life on Earth once, and they're coming back to do it again. The mathematical entity that is Thorpe has to find a way to convince humans of this threat, and in time to do something about it. But how? And what? Will Thorpe's carefully assembled team have any shot at saving the world? Will the Russians and Chinese help or betray? And who uploaded the cat? Icicle, a Tensor Matrix, the first Oort Chronicle, is available worldwide in hardcover, softcover, all ebook formats, and now as an audiobook narrated by Trenton Bennett, including music and sound effects. Icicle, a Tensor Matrix, is proudly published by Fresh Ink Group.
And Robert Willis Croft, he's out there in the audience tonight, and he tweeted here a little while ago, yay, a hard science fiction writer. no.
And she said Highline, too.
Now, Marcia, Stephen had mentioned while reading your bio, you worked for NASA. I'm really curious to know about this. I know a little bit about it, but tell our listening audience a little bit about that, working for NASA.
It was, I borrowed from Dickens, the best of times and the worst of times. It was a dream that I had since I was a child, and I remember when I just went there the first time and went through the front gate, and they had a big old Saturn V out in front, and it was just absolutely a dream come true to work there. And then, you know, it really was good in many, many ways throughout the 21 years that I was there. But of course, eventually all that initial kind of honeymoon period, if you will, kind of dissipated. And there were so many things about NASA that surprised me in the lack of continuity that they had and lack of communication between different directorates and even departments within them. For example, where I worked originally in life sciences, some people had Macs and some people had PCs. And all the documentation, you would think that all NASA documentation would all be in one place. No, it's not. It was scattered all over. And I know some years ago, actually when I was still there, they were looking for the plans to the Saturn V and they could not find them.
Oh, that was an important
course,
one too.
But they were probably with the original contractor, because that's another thing, and I think a lot of why this happens is the vast majority of the work, at least nowadays, is done by contractors. And not only is it done by contractors, but those contractors can change. They might have the big original ones like Boeing and, you know, the big aerospace giants are fairly permanent that way. But all the smaller companies that do a lot of the support tasks, they change all the time. I worked in the same basic job. Well, not so much job, because I changed jobs, but I worked for the same contract, and it was the safety contract. And I worked for, let's see, I think I worked for five different companies on that contract. And I'd have a contract for a couple of years. It would come up for rebid, and maybe the company that you were working for before didn't win and someone else did. And then you would go through what they call the badge change. And that was basically the bulk of it. You usually got the same salary. The benefits would change because they would go over to whatever benefit package that particular company already had. And they, you know, the benefit changes could be difficult. And, of course, as far as retirement, you were completely on your own with 401ks. There was no pension plan or anything like that. And so every couple of years, you'd go through a badge change. And it was kind of nerve-wracking, but that was the way it was. And so I know one time, even when I was changing jobs, and I asked my manager, I said, well, what do I do with all these records I have? And they just kind of shrugged. You know, they didn't have an archiving system. And it just kind of amazed me. It's like, how can they be so disorganized? Just unbelievable. And then as years went on, it just grew into a big bureaucratic monolith of a lot of people. And the contractors were doing most of the work. And a lot of the NASA people did was ask for reports. And that was kind of about the time I thought, okay, it's time to retire. This is not why I got brain hemorrhages studying physics to write up reports, you know?
Yeah. Now, before you retired, again, as Stephen had read in your bio, you were there for the Columbia accident.
Yes,
what do you remember of that?
Whew, I remember probably too much of that. It was a Saturday, and so of course when it happened, I was home, and I get a call from someone and tells me about it, and of course you're in shock, and so we went into work, because at the time I was working in the area that did the safety of the payloads that were either in the cargo bay or inside the mid deck and other parts of the shuttle. And the recovery crew needed to know what those were and if any of them had any toxic substances that could be a danger to the recovery crew. So we were all in there compiling all this information and transmitting it. And that was pretty intense at that time, that first day when everybody was just completely in shock that it had happened in the first place. And then as the time marched on, and then they were looking for volunteers to go out to East Texas, where part of the shuttle had broken up. Their debris path basically went from Dallas and then across East Texas and a little bit into western Louisiana. And so I volunteered to do that. I thought, if I want to have some good stories to tell my grandkids someday, I need to go out there and do this. And so I did. I was out there for, I think it was 2 weeks. And during that time, we would get up at 0:30 and we would assemble in the mess hall of the command center they set up. I was in a little town called Hemp Hill, Texas. And we would have our breakfast and we'd get our packs and we'd load them up. And this, I look back now, I don't know how I did it, because we had a pretty hefty pack with our food and our water and all this kind of stuff. They dressed us up in such a way that we had to, it was like Forest Service outfits. And we were all basically dressed the same, these green pants and these yellow shirts and the hard hat. And you would tape, you would use duct tape to tape the top of your boots to your pants so that any bugs or whatever couldn't get down into your boots. So we all look real attractive out there looking like that. In fact, funny story, one time in the evening after I went back to my hotel and I cleaned myself up and I went to a local restaurant to get something to eat, and I saw some of these guys that I knew from out in the field, and I kind of waved at them and they gave me this funny look. They didn't recognize me. And when I saw him the next day, it was like, hey, what was the matter with you? I was saying hello to you in the restaurant last night. And they go, oh, that was you. It's like, yeah, I clean up a little bit, you know. So anyway, but that was quite an adventure. We would walk, 10, 15 miles a day or so, and we'd stop for lunch somewhere. And most people took a nap, myself included. And most of our team was Native Americans, which was really interesting. Each team had maybe 20 people, and we'd walk a grid pattern through the woods, literally through the woods. There wasn't much that stopped us. We went in as straight lines as possible. But the Native Americans were normally smoke jumpers in Arizona and New Mexico for the summer fires that always break out in those particular areas. And this was in the spring. It was February, March time frame when we were doing this. So they didn't have any fires then. So they all came out and were helping with the grid search. And then each team would have maybe 2 NASA people on it. And when they'd find something, they'd bring it to us and show it to us, and we would be able to tell, is this a part of the shuttle or just some other piece of whatever out there in the boonies? And so we did a whole lot of walking, and it was just an incredible experience. Some of the things that we found this baseball. And, you know, at first we thought, oh, well, just some kid lost that out here. But the one side of the baseball was all burned where it had come through on entry. And it just kind of blew our mind. It blew our minds because, you know, we did a lot of crying out there in the field when you'd find something like that, because you just knew that someone was flying that for probably their son, their grandson, their, you know, little league person, or, you know, it was a personal thing. And when you found that, or food bags with an astronaut's name on it, it's like, oh, no, you know, this is real, and it's so sad. And yeah, it was a very, very, transformational experience, just one that you just don't have. Historical, and then to be so deeply involved in it on a personal level. I am so glad I did that.
Yeah,
you know, the happiest memory, but it was certainly a strong one and something that I'm glad and proud to say that I participated in that.
Yeah, that was a very sad time. Our Ann, who I mentioned earlier, living near Dallas with her husband, it was a big deal in Texas, you know, what time to see the shuttle go outside so you can track its descent across Texas. And I believe it was early morning. She said that they got up early, and she and her husband, they made their coffee, went out on the deck, and then spotted the shuttle. And they actually tracked the shuttle across the sky and then saw it start breaking up. And she said that it was eerie because there was never a sound. I mean, you expect like to see something like that, and then, you know, 5 seconds later to hear an explosion or something, and there was never a sound. She said it was just visual, and all they could do is just, she sat there and cried, knowing what had happened. Terrible time.
Wow.
So your hobbies are interesting, Marcia. In particular, you recently bought a camera so that you could take some pictures, and what sounds like a lot of fun to me is star parties with an astronomy group.
I miss my astronomy group. Unfortunately, they moved their venue. They were centered in Austin, which is about 80 miles or so from where I live. But of course, in Austin, the skies are so light from it being a city that they do their star parties out by me at this one resort. And so I used to go to the star parties, and they were just so wonderful. I just love the stars and the planets, and it was really a lot of fun to go to those. But then the resort where they were meeting kind of threw them out. So that went away, but I was happy to have that experience. And I hope at some point to get a telescope of my own and be able to do that again from my own house, because I do have clear skies. But the last several years, we've had some really interesting-looking things in the sky with the planets. Like right now, where Jupiter and Saturn are so close together and you can really see them, they really stand out. And I wanted to be able to get pictures of these things. And the cell phone just absolutely failed me miserably on these things, even trying to take pictures of the moon. So I thought,
me too.
Yeah. So I got a little camera on Amazon. And it has done a much better job on the moon. I've gotten some real fun shots of the moon where you can see the craters and all that detail. That was really a lot of fun to do. But the planets, not so much. You can tell it's a planet and not a star, but it doesn't show all the detail like we're familiar with Jupiter, where it's kind of has those stripes on it, the red spot and all that sort of thing. It doesn't show up. And the same with Mars. It looked pinkish, but you couldn't really see the detail. So someday I will get a telescope and get some good pictures of those. There's some astrophotography groups on Facebook that are just mind-boggling. They get some pictures there when they have the right equipment that are, to me, I would have thought they were taken with the Hubble. I was amazed at some of the pictures that they get. So I thought, okay, that's on my list. That's on my bucket list. Someday I'll get myself a decent telescope and really try to get some great pictures of the stars and planets and what have you out there.
So you're also a closet astrologer. How did this come about?
Well, not so much closet anymore, but I got to tell you though, along those lines, I should have been more of a closet astrologer here in the Hill Country, because this is a Bible Belt, and I have been really ostracized by some of the people around here because I'm an astrologer. They think I'm, you know, some kind of a devil or a witch or something, I guess. I don't know.
Well, that's a shame, because I'm a Christian and I know the Bible, and there were star readers in the Bible.
Oh, of course there were.
They would
tell whether
the fight
also
was good to go today or not. You know, I don't know.
Well, it defies logic, because if you're a Christian and you believe that God created the planets, why wouldn't any message that can be derived from their symbolism be from God? You know, it totally defies logic, but a lot of people.
I agree.
But anyway, yeah, I took my science fiction books into the local library and talked to the librarian or whatever, and I offered to come in and talk to the kids and, you know, anything that I could do to help them out, I would be willing to. Never heard a thing back, and went back another time, even when it was space gear or something. It was the anniversary of Apollo, and the whole summer program was based on space. Went back, volunteered again, not a word. And so the only thing I could figure is she Googled my name, and the astrology came up, and that was it. Because I got some pretty icy looks when I went in there to talk to them. And I never really confronted them on it. I thought, it's not worth it. But anyway, so yes, I got into astrology largely kind of to debunk it. That, you know, you hear about it and then you go to school and you're in college and you're taking astronomy classes and they're telling you, oh, it's a bunch of baloney and all this stuff. So I never take people's word for it. I always want to check it out myself. So the first book I came upon was a classic that's out there, probably literally millions of copies, and that's Linda Goodman's Sun Signs. That was where I started. And I read that, and it's like, huh, this really fits the people I know extremely well. And so I just kept kind of accumulating more knowledge about it. And one thing I found from the Linda Goodman Sun Sign book, as an author, astrology is extremely handy for developing characters. Extremely handy. Anyone who has trouble developing a character's personality and everything else, they ought to get a copy of that book, decide what their sun sign is, and boy, it tells you all kinds of very, very useful things about that person. So anyway, I didn't do much with it until I was still a couple of years before I retired, and then I actually took some serious study classes with it's called the International Academy of Astrology, and I've studied online with them for 4 years in a pretty intensive program. When I first started taking classes, I thought I knew quite a bit, and boy, I found out real quick that I hardly knew a thing. But by the time I got out, I was qualified to be a professional, and that was one of the ways that I have supplemented my income since I retired. And I have clients around the world, and how they find me, I have no clue. But I have clients in Singapore and New Zealand and, of course, the United States and in Europe. And it has been a tremendous amount of fun meeting these people. A lot of them, I think I know them better than I know my own family. Because, you know, for one thing, I'm safe. I'm not even in the same country. They can tell me all their deep, dark secrets, right? But it's really fun. And it amazes me no end. It totally amazes me. I have no idea how it works. I have my own little ideas as a physicist, and it's somewhere there in quantum theory, and there's enough of the mystery there between quantum theory and the interface with consciousness, and it makes sense that it's operating in there somewhere. And someday we'll figure it out, and all the skeptics are going to be eating some serious crow, because it does work. It's just no one knows how. Doesn't mean it doesn't work, just means we don't know how.
So since you became expert, then that led to the book Who Beat His Guide to Basic Astrology by Marcia Fox. So,
that's right.
Tell us about that book.
Well, it started with my website. My astrology website is valkyrieastrology.com, and a friend of mine was teaching classes in astrology, and he told me, I'm using your website for my students to use for reference material. And I thought, well, maybe I ought to compile it into a book. And I got to say, I was kind of surprised. I got a 280-something page book off my website, and actually my website has even more on it, a lot of things that I didn't include in the book. But these are things kind of along the line of the reason I include science in my science fiction. These are the things that I wanted to read when I was first learning astrology. It's Astrology 101. It's the basics for people where they can kind of understand if they're talking to an astrologer or they read something about it, when they're talking about aspects and transits and all this terminology that's specific to astrology, they read my book and they know what they're talking about. And it's just that basic. I kind of wrote it in a very light tone where it's supposed to be funny. I mean, some of it that's supposed to be funny might be offensive to some people. You know how that goes. But, that was kind of what I wrote. Who Beat Is. It was already written. I just had to reformat it into a book.
And that book is available in ebook editions, and it's also available in paperback. So you can find it at places like Amazon or other places where you buy your books.
Yes, Yes, it's available through all of them, Apple and Barnes & Noble. It's not exclusive to Amazon. It is all over the place, an ebook or print.
Good.
Or if you're really if you're a masochist about it, you can just go to my website and read my website. But then, like I say, that hyperlink bingo, it'll drive you crazy. It's a lot easier to have it in the book.
Yeah, you had mentioned earlier, I briefly mentioned it, your tetralogy. Can you share that?
How
about that?
Well, that was my first book. And I guess to be all super honest about it, I would have to say that Star Wars was much of the original inspiration, where my thought was, you know, what if a family was moving from one planet to another and one of their kids accidentally got fired off in an escape pod? And so that was kind of the premise, and it happened. And then naturally the family was trying to find her and get into all kinds of scrapes and trying to get the family back together. The father is an important figure, and so there's these different bad guys, kind of the equivalent of like the evil empire in Star Wars, where they're trying to recruit him for his scientific skills and using, they're thinking if they can find his daughter, they can use her as bait and all kinds of things like that. The characters all became too strong, and they started running the story, which always happens with my books, that they get completely out of control, and they drive the plot. And so it got pretty complicated. That's why it wasn't just a single book. It turned into five, actually, with the Terra debacle. So they wind up on this planet that's basically, I guess you could compare it even to Mars or something. It's very dry, and it has extreme seasons. It has this, it's a binary star system, and the orbit makes a figure eight around the two stars. It's called a lemniscate. And the rotation of the planet, instead of kind of upright like the Earth, it's more on its side, kind of like a rotisserie. So as it goes around these two stars, it has this really, really brutal weather where it's super hot sometimes and super cold and dark others. And so, of course, that survival element of a planet like that is a large part of the plot and how they're going to survive when they wind up in very primitive conditions. So it's, like I said, it's not a simple story and all kinds of details. And I had all kinds of fun with the actual physics of that and the orbits and calculating the how long it would take to go around and the days and what would the two stars look like in the sky at certain times of their cycle. And I was using a globe and an orange and a flashlight more than once trying to figure this stuff out. But it was fun to write that. And I still might, when I finish this other series I'm working on now, I still might come back and write one final wrap-it-all-up novel for that series and get all of, you know, connect all of the characters and everything in one final wrap-up. So we'll get to that someday.
Well, I look forward to that. The books in that series, by the way, are Beyond the Hidden Sky, A Dark of Endless Days, A Silent Place Below with Silent spelled T-S-I, Refractions of Frozen Time, and then the one we talked about focusing more on the sentient plant, the Terra debacle, Prisoners at Area 51, which is frankly my favorite. if you go out there looking around too, you'll see there's a few other Marcia Fox books. She covers different topics. One that I've always found fun is the Family History Fun Factor. But there's a new book coming out. I believe it's out now. Is it in pre-sale or did it just come out, Marcia?
No, it's been out since July, actually.
Oh, okay. It's called The Curse of Dead Horse Canyon. It's book one of the Cheyenne Spirits series. And I'm going to read you a real quick blurb, and then we're going to ask Marcia about it. In 1878, a drunken horde of silver miners raided a Cheyenne village while the tribe's warriors hunted buffalo. A small band of young braves, not yet old enough to join the hunt, escaped and rode for help. Their efforts failed when they were discovered by the raiders, who ran them over a cliff along with all the tribe's horses that had been left behind. When the warriors returned and found the devastation, the tribe's medicine man, Black Cloud, placed a curse on the site. Century and a half later, a scandalous top secret project is under construction in the same Colorado wilderness. Brian Reynolds discovers that its roots lie in the same greed, corruption, and exploitation of the earth that precipitated the curse. But before he can expose what he's found, he's killed in a suspicious accident that his wife, Sarah, miraculously survives. Her memory of where they were or what they discovered, however, is gone. Neither Sarah nor Brian's lifelong Cheyenne friend, Charlie Little Wolf, will rest until they find out what Brian discovered that resulted in his death. Charlie is acutely aware that the only way to solve the mystery is through connecting with the grandfather spirits. To do so, he must return to his roots and the teachings of his medicine man grandfather. His journey back to the Cheyenne Way includes ancient rituals and ceremonies that guide him and Sarah to the answers they seek. Marcia, you have a co-author on this one, Pete Rising's son. Tell us about him.
Well, since one of the main characters is a Native American, I needed a Native American to give me a sanity check. I have a stack of books that I use for research. I mean, a stack that is probably 2 feet high of these books that I've acquired in researching this book. But research does not always do it. And so through kind of a few little series of little minor miracles, I found Pete, and at first I hired him as a subject matter expert to read through the book and let me know, you know, anything that was off. And he immediately found a couple things that were just not true of the Cheyenne. In fact, there's 2 Cheyenne tribes, the northern and the southern, and they split at one point. And one of, you know, the southern Cheyenne basically went down in, you know, the Oklahoma area in that general direction. And the northern Cheyenne, they would not be removed from where their homeland was. And with a small band of a few hundred people, they basically escaped and headed home. And most of them died along the way. But when they finally did get there, they let them stay. But they do have slightly different practices. And a lot of the practices that I had found were for the southern. And then I get Pete, who's northern Cheyenne. He's like, I never heard of that. You know, and he had the experience working with medicine men and whatever that he, if anyone, would have known. So it was important for me to get it straightened out. But it wasn't very long working with Pete where he was obviously really getting into my character. And he started coming up with all these things about his life and experiences, and he was helping me actually write the story. It wasn't just correcting anything I had in there that was wrong. He was actually participating in the story. So at a certain point, he just said, don't pay me anymore. You know, I'll help you do the rest of your book, but we're good. And I says, well, I owe you more than that. You need to be recognized as a co-author on this book, because he really has written 95% of that character's part in this.
Oh, how so fun.
Yeah. Oh, I've learned so much. And Pete is just such a character. He's just amazing. We've talked a lot on the phone, and he's, most of our collaboration was through text messaging, which was quite a challenge to manage all that. And we're currently right now gearing up to start on the next book in the series. But this book, it's funny how it began. It's obviously very different than my science fiction that I've always written. And it actually started out as an idea for a cozy mystery. And clearly from the description that you just read, you can tell it's really not very cozy. But it started out that way because I live in a little rural neighborhood, a lot of retirees, and I had some ideas based on my little community of a mystery, a cozy mystery. And I thought, oh, I can't set it in Texas because people will probably try to sue me because they'll recognize themselves or something, right? So I thought, where can I set it besides Texas? I thought, okay, I used to live in Utah. Utah is kind of, you know, similar to Colorado, both Rocky Mountains and stuff like that. So let's shoot for Colorado. So I started researching Colorado. And then all of their history started coming out about the mines and the pollution they left behind and then the Native American connection through all that. And I got a history lesson that I had no clue about before. And, of course, I'm eating all this up, though. It's like, oh, yeah, I can use that in this story and tie it all together. But it's pretty hilarious that it started out as a cozy mystery. And now a couple of years later, only one book is out and two more to come before we tell the whole story. So that was kind of how it evolved into what it is when I got into all of the history of the 1800s and so and in Colorado. And there is pollution issues from those mines. They have these EPA super funds that are supposed to go up there and clean it up, and sometimes they mess up and make a bigger mess than it was to begin with, and all kinds of things. And of course nowadays we have fracking and a lot of that's going on up there. And anyway, I had a very target rich environment once I started learning a little bit about what was going on up there between that and my imagination. And then pretty soon I had a book that was not a cozy mystery, even though that's still what it's called on my directory on my computer.
Okay.
So is Pete a big shot among his friends now?
Oh, I'm sure he is. As soon as we published the book, he ordered a box of books, and we had them delivered to me, so I could sign them all and then ship them up to him because he's in Montana. He lives on the reservation up there. And then he signed them and he's selling them. And he's selling them to his, you know, friends and whatever. And he is quite a celebrity now. And I think that's
wow.
So awesome for him. And the book wouldn't be nearly what it is without his input and his really adopting that character and going for it. Totally. And there's a lot of details in that book about building a sweat lodge and conducting a sweat and their sacred pipe and all of these things that they do, that they honest to goodness really do, and very authentic. And it's been just such a trip for me to learn all this and incorporate that in there. And it has enriched the story incredibly. And I was kind of worried at first if it would be boring to some people. And, you know, I had this one daughter who read the book, and I asked her, I said, were those parts boring? You know, because I knew she'd be honest with me. And she said, no, they were interesting. So far, I guess people are interested in it. Seems to be doing okay so far.
That's great. I did a lot of research for one of the books that I wrote on Anasazi rituals and traditions and things like that. And it was just fascinating. I learned so much. And, you know, those aren't kinds of things that I would follow personally, but to understand the background, the history, and the culture. And I think in this case, Pete Rising Sun should be proud of how he's helping people learn about his culture, you know, through
compelling
story.
That was his motivation. He told, in fact, he's been working on an interview for me to post on our website for this story. It's deadhorsecanyon.com is our website. And he, you know, I said it's good for us to post little interviews about ourselves out there in the press kit. So he's been working on his. And one thing he mentioned as part of the questions was, you know, how did you come to agree to do this? And he actually did it in the ways that are described in here with these rituals, where he went to a sweat and he was asking there and whether he should do this. And he got the answer that he should do it for his people so that people would know about them. And that was why he agreed to do the work.
Wonderful.
So, yeah. And it really, I didn't even know that before. It was when I was transcribing his answers to these questions. He wrote them out by hand, took a picture with his cell phone, and sent it to me. And so then I type it up and put it out there. And I was so touched when I read that part. It's like, oh, my gosh, I didn't even know that. That is so cool. So anyway, yeah, he's a great man. He really is. He's 70 years old, which is actually younger than me, but we won't say that. But anyway, yeah, he's got a lot of history behind him. He has a college education. He worked for Exxon for a couple of years after he got out of college, and then he just didn't like that at all. He wanted to go home to the reservation, and a job for education director for his tribe came up, and he was offered the job, and he went home, and then he was doing that, and he was raising quarter horses and cattle, and he was even the county commissioner for their county at one time, the first Northern Cheyenne who held that position. So he's a very, very impressive person. Just an incredible, his biography is very impressive. The credentials he has, besides being well-versed in his culture, I was lucky to find him. It was nothing short of a miracle that we somehow connected.
And the book is The Curse of Dead Horse Canyon by Marcia Fox and Pete Risingson, book one of the Cheyenne Spirits series. We encourage everybody to go out there and try that book out. It's a wonderful tale by two very fascinating authors. Marcia, we're about out of time here. Can we wrap up with you telling our listeners how they can find you, your website, or how to find you on social media?
Sure can. I'm on Facebook, Marcia Fox Author. And Marcia is spelled weird, M-A-R-C-H-A. My mom got creative there. And so if you just Google me, if nothing else, I'm sure it'll all come up. On Instagram, I'm Star Trails Saga, and on Twitter, I'm Star Trails IV for four. The Dead Horse Canyon website is dead-horse-canyon.com. The Star Trails website is startrailssaga.com, but with no dashes, just one big word. And then my Hubita website is ValkyrieAstrology.com. So you can see why I'm a little bit crazy trying to keep up with all these websites and everything. I would like to give blood and pay money for a PA, you know?
Well, thank you for joining us tonight, Marcia. We definitely got to have you on again sometime. And maybe next time my voice will be back strong and I'll be able to participate a little more. But thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Marcia. Well, it's fun.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And listeners, thank you for joining us. And to all of you that left messages on Twitter, thank you. Robert and Ronnie and Verwayne, thank you. And we will be back again next week, Wednesday, 8 o'clock, as usual, with another episode and another guest.
Thanks, Marcia.
Thank you. It's been very much fun.
See you later, Stephen.
You've been a part of Voice of Indy, a production of Fresh Ink Group. Spread the word, support our guests, then find us at freshinkgroup.com and be sure to hashtag Fresh Ink Group.